In your Bibles, please, to Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17, verse 1. Hear now the inerrant, infallible, and inspired Word of God. And there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, and I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. And I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints, and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. And the angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman, and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the seven heads and ten horns. The beast that thou sawest was, and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven and goeth into perdition. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he saith unto me, The waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God hath put it in their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree, and to give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. May God add his blessing to the reading and to the hearing of his most holy word. So among faithful commentators, there is really little disagreement as to the identity of this woman that sits upon the beast. And I think that's because it really is so very clear. So, notice what John says about her, and notice how this helps us as we read even John's epistles, especially 1 John chapter 4 and 2 John. John calls this woman mystery, comma, and I think the Authorized Version has it exactly right by putting that comma there. Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations. There are only two women in visionary form in the entirety of the book of Revelation. Once we begin the visions in chapter 6, there are only two women spoken of. There's the one woman that gives birth to Messiah. And then we see her again later as she is that bride adorned for her husband coming down out of heaven, the New Jerusalem, which is the church. The church of all ages considered from the perspective of God. And then there's this other woman that we see here. We've seen her before, now we see her again, and this is her chapter. This is the chapter where she is explained. This is the divine understanding of all, not just one, but all false religion. But notice that there is one that ascends as the mother of harlots. Just like John will say in his epistle that there are many antichrists gone out into the world. And then he will speak of, in the original, with the article, there is the antichrist. So also, there are many harlots gone out into the world. But there is really only one that is the mother of them all. And of course, we understand that to be the Roman Church. Now, you'll have some commentators that are perhaps not as literally interested as others, but all faithful commentators recognize that what is being identified here in chapter 17 is the epitome of false religion. What J.A. Wiley will call Satan's masterpiece. He has hidden the mother, Satan has hidden the mother of harlotries under the name Christian. So, let's take a look at her for a few moments with the Apostle John, and let's understand what John says about her and what he reveals concerning her. First of all, she is known as an unfaithful woman, a whore, a harlot. She seduces, she allures, she draws away and is unfaithful to her own professed husband. She has committed fornication with the kings of the earth. She has entertained them for their favors. Notice that she is a woman. She is a church, a false religion. This anti-church was not only in seed form in John's day, but over the course of the centuries, she has grown up into this masterpiece that we talked about a moment ago. She sits upon many waters. She has authority and influence over the tumultuous world of unbelievers. She has sway over them. And this is also an allusion, remember, to the city of Babylon, which was situated upon the river of many waters, upon the river Euphrates itself. If you've ever taken a look at your map in that area of what we would call Mesopotamia, where the Euphrates flows and where ancient Babylon sat, you will see that it doesn't look like a river at that particular point. It looks like an estuary. There are many rivulets as it spreads out in that desert valley there. Okay? It's many waters. And so that becomes an allusion for the people of the world, as John will make explicit here, as he will explain the waters late in the chapter. These are nations and peoples and so on. She has made the inhabitants of the earth drunk with the wine of her fornication. Now, we must open up here. It's a difficult, a sensitive thing, but it is most important that we remember what false religion looked like in John's day. Can I say it this way? I hope you'll understand what I mean, trying to be sensitive here, but that it was seeker-friendly to the maximum amount. There were things going on there that were so very carnal that make seeker-friendly services today pikers, amateurs in comparison. So she, this church, has made the inhabitants of the world drunk with the wine of her fornication, that is, of her idolatries. She is sumptuous. She is opulent. She is rich. She appeals to the flesh. This is what our reforming divines, when they referred to the Roman church, they called her a voluptuous church with a voluptuous worship. That is, that it appeals to the flesh. It appeals to our baser selves. And the more we learn about this church and what she has done over the centuries, the more that becomes clear and more explicit. She sits upon the beast. Now, the beast here, this is an allusion to chapter 11. This is a very interesting thing, and it's, I think, multiple in its signification. First of all, she sits upon the beast. She has committed fornication with the kings of the earth, especially. The beast represents, remember, bestial governments that do not worship Christ, that do not give up or call upon Him for their authority, but rather, instead, they have thrown Him off. They are beast-like in the way that they govern. And so she is raised up and supported by the beast. But notice that this beast is a little bit different in its description. It's red. It's scarlet in color. And red is the color of blood and violence. And so with this church, coupled together with this state, with this bestial state, they have persecuted the saints of God. They have shed their blood through martyrdom and other things. Well, if you just think about what was going on during the late Middle Ages, before the Reformation, and then immediately after the Reformation had gotten started, you remember that the church and state banded together to shed the blood of the faithful. Well, it's not only going to happen in that time. It's going to happen in other times as well throughout the inner Advent age. But it happens most gloriously, most notoriously in that day. We could expect that to ebb and to flow throughout the rest of human history. Okay? Now notice also, so she sits upon that beast. She is supported and lifted up by it. She propagates the message and the mission of the beast. This beast is scarlet. It looks very much like the dragon in chapter 12, but it is the earthly embodiment of the dragon. That's why it has dragon-like characteristics. Seven heads, 10 horns. These speak of the authority and the power. We saw this beast from the sea in chapter 13. Only here he is described as red, showing his violent and draconian character and the source of his beastliness. The woman, she is arrayed in purple and scarlet and gold and jewels. This is to represent her sumptuous living, her worldliness, her avarice, and her indulgence. And further, she is red like the beast. She is dressed in scarlet because they are both vicious against the saints of God. The beast and the woman. She has this golden cup. This is indicative of that masterful deception that she holds. What would you expect to drink from a golden cup? You would expect it to be rich and pleasant. But what is it full of? It is full of abominations instead. It is full of all kinds of deception and abomination. It is full of the abominations of her fornications. That is, it is full of her false religion, that of the beast and of the inhabitants of the earth. It is the religion, most properly, of self-sufficiency. And we make note of the golden chalice of the Roman Church here as that to which this cup here points most properly. So then notice she also wears a headdress. Now some commentators are going to tell you that harlots wore headdresses in those days. See, I think that this is something a little bit different than that. See if you can go with me on this. Remember that when Aaron was put into the priesthood, that he was arrayed very richly, very wonderfully. And then at the end, what was the last piece of Aaron's outfit? What was the last piece? You remember? There was a turban put on his head, right? A winding. But then there was something after that. There was a plate that was to cover his forehead. And what did it say? Holiness to the Lord. Notice that at the end of the description of the building up of her attire, she has something on her forehead as well. It doesn't say holiness to the Lord. What does it say? Mystery. Babylon the Great. The mother of harlots and fornications. And so as Aaron had in his high priestly work, that plate that said holiness to the Lord. So may I say it this way? Can you come with me this far? So the priest, the high priest of that religion also has something upon his forehead, which is mystery. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of idolatries and spiritual fornication. So the outfit then is complete. It is that mimicking, as we've seen throughout. It is the attempt to be anti-Christ, to look like Christ, to speak like Christ. Remember, we had the beast that came up out of the sea in contrast to the beast that came up out of the land. There was a bestial government, civil government, back a few chapters ago, and there was a bestial church. And that bestial church was the beast that came up out of the land, had two horns like a lamb, but spoke like a dragon. This is who we have here. She is making her attempt to look like the high priest of old. But instead, she has another message on her forehead. She is drunk with the blood of the saints. This system of this world will not tolerate the existence of God's people, but will put them to death at every turn. Thus it was in the days of the Protestant Reformation. Thus it was even in John's day. Thus it is in China and North Korea today. Any system, whether ecclesiastical or civil, that persecutes God's people is a manifestation of or is in league with this woman, this beast-like state and this beast-like church. She sits on seven mountains. This is a twofold allusion, right? Rome has often, throughout history, been known as the city of seven hills. But more than that, we're going to learn that these seven mountains, these seven heads, are seven kings. Five have been, one is yet to be. And then notice that this seventh king, these seven kings all actually, they give up to something that is called the eighth king. But this eighth king is a manifestation that is more than simply civil. It is indeed the embodiment of that unholy merging between church and state that we see here between the Roman church and the state. Did you know that? Did you know that the Vatican maintains an embassage at the UN as a state itself? It is not just a church. It is also known as an independent civil estate in this world. And that unholy merging of the church and state means, well, it is taught here in that they are both bestial, but notice that it is taught especially in that they are brought together in that mother of harlots. And then finally, it says that she sits on many waters, and this alludes to her widespread influence. It is worldwide. It is throughout the heathen nations. And the end of this chapter calls her Babylon, the great city. This is no place and every place. It is all false religion and the love of this world thrown up into one principle. It is embodied in its most formal manifestation in the Roman Catholic Church. But we must not limit it to the Roman Catholic Church. All right, so that's the description. Now we go on to the history. I will tell thee the mystery of the woman. This is the second section, beginning in verse 7. So notice the beast was and is not and shall come out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. It's an obvious allusion to chapter 11 and verse 7. This is a mocking caricature of the beast. The scene, remember what is said, what Christ says of himself. I am he who was and who is to come. And so John turns the tables on the beast because he endeavors to represent himself as a Messiah figure. And so he was and is not, and he will go into perdition. And then he will say also that he was and is not and yet is. And so this speaks to the, can I say it this way, the fortunes of civil government throughout the world. What happens during the days of the Middle Ages? What do the kings of the known world end up doing? What do? They end up bowing before the Roman pontiff, don't they? They give up their authority. What does the Roman pontiff do? He formalizes that and takes civil authority to himself. And so this beast was and is not and yet is in that sense. And it is a mocking caricature of this beast that attempts to arrogate to itself divine prerogatives. So this eighth king, that final manifestation of the beast, will be a repeat of that which has gone before this recognized state church of Roman Catholicism. All right, so then we have what I think is perhaps the most puzzling portion of this chapter. First of all, it says, these 10 kings shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. So there's going to be, again, as we've seen before, this great battle. This great battle, as we saw last week, of Har Megiddo, right? This battle of Armageddon, or this Valley of Judgment, this place where decisive battles have taken place in the history of God's people. Again, they're going to be gathered and they're going to rise up against Christ, and Christ will indeed punish them. But then there's this other portion. These kings, having consorted with the harlot for so long, one day they will rise up and they will stop consorting with her. The Lord God will put it in their hearts to turn on her. And this is where there are two paths in the faithful commentators. And I'll give you both, because they're both worthy of your consideration. Those Puritans that would call themselves historicist and postmillennial will look at the path that we are seeing here, and this final judgment or battle between the Roman Catholic Church and the kings of the earth. They have consorted for so long. And then there will come a time where the anti-religion, antichrist, will meet its demise. As she will come under the judgment of the Lord through these 10 kings, through the kings of the earth in that day. And this ushers in what many of our Puritan fathers called the millennium, or this golden age of the prosperity of the true gospel of Jesus Christ after Rome has been dispatched. That would be the position of James Durham, E.B. Eliot, and many others. Okay, Wilhelmus of Brockle. That post-millennial understanding of the greatest enemy of the church is this mother of harlots and those with whom she consorts in the state. That consortium will come to an end. She will be defeated, and then the kings of the earth will give their authority to Christ, and then he will reign over the earth from heaven for an extended period of blessing. That is the what has been called by some the Puritan hope. And sadly, that's not my view. I wish it was. I could say I stand with all those other men, but I don't. I don't. I believe that this is an end of days kind of throwing off. That there is a short space, not only of apostasy, but a short space also of the kings of the earth throwing Rome into the dustbin of history. That there will come a day when they become tired, worn out of all of the sumptuousness, of all of the stuff, of all of those fleshly indulgences. Finally, they will recognize that they are too costly. They are a drag, a draw. They are a weakening rather than a strengthening. I don't know whether or not This will be a godly throwing off or an ungodly throwing off of Rome? I rather suspect it will be an ungodly throwing off of Rome. And we will have that final apostasy that we'll read about for a short space in Revelation chapter 20 that we've already seen. But there is a time coming when Rome will no longer be a state. She will be thrown off. Oh, I don't think she'll be thrown off in that she'll disappear. But she will lose that authority that she's had over the kings of the earth. If she's not lost much of it already, there are those that believe that she's still pulling strings behind the scenes in the governments and halls of civil authority throughout the world today. That she's doing that clandestinely and secretly. Listen, nothing would surprise me concerning that church. Nothing would surprise me. But there is a day coming when the kings of the earth will be stirred up by Christ, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, that great and illustrious King. And what He will do is He will stir them up to throw off her influence once and for all. And I believe that to be toward the end of the ages. All right, thus ends the reading then of Revelation chapter 17. As we move on, Lord willing, to chapter 18, next hour, what we see there then is the description of that day when she is thrown off.